Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Hands down, Halloween is my absolute favorite holiday. Ghosts and ghouls of Louisiana join us this week in celebration of All Hallows' Eve. We'll travel to Mamou, where Valerie Cahill gives us a tour of the very haunted Hotel Kazan, where ghosts pop up from behind the bar and have even frequented the ice cream parlor. Then, we'll head down to the epicenter of hauntings in the Crescent City for a specially guided ghost tour of Antoine's with Lisa Blunt, wife of fifth-generation proprietor Rick Blunt. Even Antoine's waiters chime in with haunting personal experiences from one of America's oldest restaurants. Finally, if you'd like to see some ghosts this Halloween, just do a few shots of Richard Pomez's spicy new libation, Ghost Tequila. We're crossing over to the other side on this week's special Halloween edition of Louisiana Eats. For 175 years, Antoine's restaurant has seen characters of all kinds cross through its expansive halls. It's no surprise, then, that individuals who balance between this dimension and the next have made the restaurant home. Lisa Blunt, proprietress of Antoine's, gave us a personal tour of their spookiest sites, including a space that's affectionately known as the Mystery Room. Lisa remarked to us that visitors have often heard about Antoine's ghostly reputation before they even walk through the front door.
It's funny, when we were celebrating our 175th anniversary, I was doing a lot of asking of questions and people coming around. And the number one question I get asked is about Hurricane Katrina. And the number two is ghosts. And so I went and walked around one afternoon when, you know, the waiters were around and some of the managers, and I said, has anybody ever seen ghosts? And there was lots and lots of sightings and things. So that's how it kind of came to be that we started kind of documenting some of the ghosts.
Where shall we begin this tour?
So we're going to begin right now. We're kind of more towards the back of the restaurant. We've come through the main dining room. All of these buildings are over 200 years old. We don't have the exact document on it, but we know they were called the Triples, and it was in some maps and showed them as homes. And you can see down here would have been an open courtyard, and then you would go upstairs to where the house was and where the living quarters were. So this is one of the places where a lot of people talk about seeing a woman. I have an office up there, and definitely when I'm alone, I've feel this person. And like I was talking about the mediums, we've had two mediums come through, both of them on separate occasions. We didn't ask them to come here, but they have both said, there's a woman here and she's happy and she's around. A lot of people see her. It's interesting. She's either dressed in a black dress or she's been seen in a wedding dress too. That's a very common sighting.
Have you actually seen her or do you just feel her presence?
I saw her. I did see her. I was coming upstairs once, and it was during the day, too. It was very faint, but it was definitely a woman in a long dress, you know, maybe of the 1800s, you know, late 1700s. I couldn't quite place that, and it was a quick little peek, and then she was gone. Upstairs is our accounting office, and when our CEO, Charlie DeRocca, first started, he came in on a Sunday, kind of get his desk all ready before Monday and meeting everybody. So he came in and dead quiet, you know, the restaurant at those time was closed on Sundays. So he went in there, was straightening up his desk, and all of a sudden he heard the door lock. And he's like, wow, someone's, you know, playing with the door. So he came out and he's like, hello, and nothing happened. Sat down, happened again. And so then he kind of walked out and kind of was looking around like, did I not lock a door or someone's going around here? And then he went down and sat down again. And then the shredder started going and drawers were pulled out. And he said he had one of those moments of, should I work here really? He just decided to depart. And he did come to work the next day, but he definitely had an interesting moment, as he would say, in the building.
Who are the mediums that have come through here? Did they come through on business or pleasure?
No, one of them was really interesting. Both of them were dining here. One of them I was with. And the woman looked at me and goes, I just have this feeling. And we were just sitting there. And I'm like, she goes, can I walk around? And I'm like, well, sure. And it was kind of odd, but it was like, okay, whatever. And we had a couple glasses of wine, so, you know, let's walk around. And she immediately went around and walked upstairs and she goes, there's a woman here and she's here. And have you ever felt that? And I go, well, there's been stories and things. And so she was, so it was just totally on her own that she did it. And then the other one was one night dining and kind of did the exact same thing with a waiter. They were taking a tour of the restaurant and stopped and said, wow, there's a real powerful ghost here. See a ghost anywhere?
No.
All right, let's find Charles.
Okay.
My name's Charles Carter. I'm a waiter at Antoine's restaurant, and I have a few ghost stories for you all that I personally encountered. I guess this was about 10 years ago. We were in the side alley bringing chairs upstairs, getting ready for a big party. And I came down by myself, and the light was off. And right when I opened this door, it was cold, cold, cold. To my right, where this coat hanger is, there was a person, and I know there was, like you can feel it. I opened it, and I've seen it in my peripheral vision. He was standing there. So it freaked me out a little bit, but the thing was, I went by the old phone booth in the kitchen, and my busboy was sitting there. He walked down right before me, and I was freaked out. I said, man, Alex, I walked through the hallway, and man, before I could say anything, he said, did you feel something too? He's seen the exact same thing. He was freaked out. That was the worst of the two times that I've seen something.
And remember, this is in the same area where people have talked about a man locking the doors.
It was
in
amazing.
This area.
And the other time was in the Hermes room, which, you know, I was in the front dining room doing my tip sheet, you know, getting the tip report at the end of the night. And I look over to the ladies' room, because the entrance is right by the entrance of the Hermes room at the time. It's now the Hermes bar. But I looked over, and I seen a gentleman walking through. And I thought I was the only person in the restaurant that night, because it was like 12:30 in the evening. I figured it was a waiter. Well, I asked the girl at the front desk. She said nobody else is here. So I walk over. These doors are shut right here, the Hermes room door. The room's lights off, doors are locked, ladies' room is shut down. There's no way that anybody could have walked straight through, because it only took 4 seconds. I walked from the front desk to right here. And I mean, it was just like, it had to have been a waiter that had worked here years ago. I'm telling you, walked straight into the room. The doors were locked down. It was insane. I freaked out on that one too.
Have you ever waited on anybody who's told you that they were, no?
No, I've never waited on any customers that had any ghost stories, but you never know. Some of the customers might be ghosts. They're trying to look for them.
Okay.
You got to go. Well, I can share one right quick with you.
Yeah, sure.
My name is Tyree Holmes. I've been working at Antoine's 2 years and 8 months. And it's strange, you know, but, and it's always in the same area. Everybody probably give you the same story over in the mystery room. And I know I'm the only one back there in the room. I'm shining silver. And I never physically seen anything face to face or like walk past me slow. It was always in a blur, you know, from my peripheral vision.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I'd be then turning around and I know I'm the only one back there. So, yeah, and it didn't happen over more than once.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mystery Room's a popular sighting.
Yeah, that's where it happens at.
Great place for a Halloween party.
Yeah, it would be.
Ghost stories from Antoine's restaurant in New Orleans, French Quarter. About a three-hour drive northeast of New Orleans, in the heart of Cajun country, is the little town of Mamou, Louisiana. Perhaps most famous for its bar and dance hall, Fred's Lounge, the town attracts tourists from all over the world looking for a taste of authentic Acadian culture. But Fred's isn't the only place drawing travelers to Mamou's sleepy little main street. Just down the road from Fred's, the historic Hotel Kazan has checked in more than its fair share of ghost hunters, all hoping to catch a glimpse of the apparitions who've never checked out. The hotel's owner, Valerie Cahill, invited the Louisiana Eats crew to spend the night in the century-old structure. But before we did, she gave us a tour of the premises, sharing stories of specters who'd be keeping us company there during our stay.
I'm Valerie Cahill, and we are in front of the historic Hotel Kazan. And this building was built as a bank in 1911. It operated as a bank, did very well. It was originally built by our founder, if you will, Kazan Fontenot. He was our district attorney. He was the tax assessor. And I don't think it's a secret to say he was a power broker. So he ran quite a far distance out from here. Mamou used to be the absolute epicenter of everything that was going on. So the cotton brokers would come here. By the 50s, this hotel was added on. And that's the period of time that Mamou was just absolutely packed. And what I found out is the history of it being haunted goes back decades and decades and decades. I started out very cynical because I had not ever seen a ghost, nor have I seen one. But what surprises me the most is people that come here from around the world, and you know they do, to come to Fred's and to see this area, the Francophone countries here, France, Tunisia, people from Quebec, they all see the same apparitions. All people see someone at the top of the stairs. Even little kids that have never heard anything about it see a man at the top of the stairs, and the people around here say that is Kazan Fontenot. And from there, you can listen down the stairs and hear what's going on in the lobby. You're looking down two of the hallways. The Paranormal Society that has the TV show, they came in from Hammond, and they did two episodes here, but they set it up with the FLIR cameras, the forward-looking infrared cameras, and they caught quite a bit of footage.
Well, so, can we go inside and do a little ghost hunting of our own?
We got to do it.
Okay.
We're going to let the ghost do some Poppy Tucker, honey. Poppy, right now you are in a historic Kazan's bar, and this has been a fixture in this area forever. So when I told you that Kazan Fontenot operated with this as his headquarters, this right here was the headquarters. You see, this is one type of the terrazzo floors. This is the pressed tin ceilings that are a perfect recreation of the original, including the original colors. And so this building has been completely renovated down to the studs, a major renovation before we came here. However, we kept the bullet hole from an early robbery when it was a bar.
Yes.
And now if you want to come back here, this is HQ for some of our apparitions.
Oh.
And now for you.
Oh, it's like the secret door.
Yes.
Okay.
The secret door is not secret anymore. When this has been set up with all the different accoutrements to see the paranormal activity that we have, this is one of the areas that really registers. But I will keep you safe.
Do you have any idea who hangs out back there in a ghostly sense?
They were not defined in a way that you could determine an identity. It's a shape. You can usually get like a gender feeling from it. And they've captured all of this on film. But no, I couldn't give an identity because I wouldn't even recognize the people going back to the 1900s. Some of them, they feel like they know who the apparition is or who the spirit is because of the context. So the ghost that goes through the cafe wall, for an example, they know who she is because of who she was in life. When we give tours of the building, which is everyday complimentary tours, we say that when you start in the lobby, you're in 2017, and we take you in a time capsule. So when we take you through the bar, you're in the early 1900s. Right now, clearly, you're in the 1950s. And so this is a 50s-themed malt shop. You see the original red countertop with the darling little red chairs.
So let me show you, speaking of ghostly apparitions, when Matilde, which looks like Matilda written down, comes like straight about through here.
Really?
And goes outside. And so I used to ask why she was going outside, and they say no, that this was actually a dining room out here going back in time. When they did a major renovation, everything stayed historic, and that was not a part of it. But by all accounts, she goes in and out as she did in life. And there is abundant capturing of that on the camera images of it.
And who is Matilde?
Matilde used to be a waitress here. And the way it was expressed to me, her happiest times were here when she was at work, maybe somewhat an unhappy marriage. And so when she was here, she was happy. And she was going back and forth and serving the people delicious food, as she persists in doing now. So commonly people see her. And the people that see her will never see each other. I'm talking about mediums from Canada, a 10-year-old from Tennessee, a developmentally disabled woman that was a guest. It is a range of people that see it, and they all see the same things. Could commonly see her, see the guy at the top of the stairs with his hair combed back. Certain things they all see, we never write it up publicly, we never put it on the website, and various people that will never meet each other, never speak in any way, see the same things.
I have to ask you, has anybody ever stayed in a room and had an apparition sort of spook them?
No questions about it, Poppy, because one morning I had a man come down and ask me if I had been in the room that he and his wife shared overnight. I said, no, sir, absolutely not, nor would I. Oh, it's okay. Did you come in the middle of the night? I'm like, yeah, no, sir, I sure did not, would not, never thought about him. Oh, really? No, it would be okay. I said, no, I didn't. Okay. Boom, he goes. Wife comes down. Hey, Val, did you happen to come in our room in the middle of the night? I'm like, no, you were in your room with your husband. No. They said, but it's okay if you did. Did you happen to come in and turn off the radio? I was like, why? Because I'm fanatic about the power bills? No, I did not. Well, what happened? They said the radio had turned off, the lights had turned off, the nightlight had turned off, and then later on something else came on that wasn't. So definitely do, and we have people that hear a child's voice, like a small child's singing voice. We had two retired Jefferson Parish police officers in the lobby one day, sitting in the lobby. And they heard a thump, and one of them said, Valerie, there's something upstairs. I said, you want to go see? You want to call the police or whatever? They never, ever could identify it. So, yes, we definitely have guests hear something, see like a vapor trail. It looks like when a plane goes through the sky, like vapor trails of diaphanous gauziness. And things that are moved, like they feel like it's like little sight gags. Something will be left in a place. I've had people say that something was replaced, like a small trifling item with a coin or something that just wasn't there before. But it's always benign, it's always friendly, and it seems to make people comfortable. And what I have been told, being no expert, because the spirits are actually at rest here, they are not disturbed spirits. So these are benign spirits. Our guests are benign and content as well. So it's really just a good fit. There's no scary element that seems disturbing.
Well, all I can say is thank you for welcoming us into your haunted hotel, and I just can hardly wait for my sleepover with your haunts.
Well, we want you to come back because you are our favorite apparition, Poppy Tooker.
Valerie Cahill of the Haunted Hotel Kazan. For those of you wondering if anyone in the Louisiana Eats crew had a run-in with those benign apparitions during our stay, I'll reserve my comments. Let's just say that this group of skeptics thought twice before turning out the lights. When we come back from a short break, we summon a different kind of spirit, a tequila infused with ghost peppers that's not for the faint of heart. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and support from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter,
home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. You probably remember the 1981 hit album by The Police, Ghost in the Machine. But have you ever heard of a ghost in a bottle? Richard Pomus has worn many hats in the service industry, but came to fame as the mastermind behind the guerrilla marketing that brought on the Fireball whiskey storm across the country. We sat down with Richard to learn more about his Fireball guerrilla marketing campaign, as well as his latest venture, a spicy liquor called Ghost Tequila. Richard, I am so happy to meet you. So you're a native New Orleanian, aren't you?
That's true. I say New Orleanian, but I grew up in Old Metairie, like most people who are from Metairie say. They lie and say New Orleans.
Yes. I'm thrilled to meet you because you're kind of a legend behind the bars here in New Orleans. I understand that the legend of Richard is a spicy one, and it all begins with Fireball. Explain to me the connection between you and Fireball.
Around the time I was 24, 25, I got contacted by this guy who said, hey, we're looking for somebody who knows how to talk to people, you know, understands the liquor industry and the service industry, and understands social media, going through these qualifications. And I was like, oh, that's me. I know how to do all these things. I'm this person. So I said, well, let's talk. What are you looking for? And they said, have you heard of this brand called Fireball Whiskey? I said, no. They asked me if I had any just top of my mind marketing ideas. You know, what do you think we should do this brand? Pitched them a couple of ideas just off the top of my head. Things like, you know, bartending competition, or you should really focus on social media, blah, blah, blah. And they said, cool, thanks for your time. Didn't hear back from them for a little while. And then they contacted me and said, do you want to manage this brand? So I said, you know, I have no traditional marketing experience, right? And they said, yeah, whatever. So I was very lucky, kind of a right time, right place kind of thing. And just grabbed the opportunity, learned a lot along the way, kind of made a lot up as I went along. The early days of social media, you didn't really have to advertise that much. You'd have to pay for advertising. So it was really easy to get in front of people on a very broad scale using social media. So that was a no-brainer. You know, so it kind of became, well, how else can we reach these people, these millennials who are on social media and not really anywhere else? What are we going to do? And so we just decided, well, let's just put the product in their mouths. So we would fly to these cities. And in the beginning, it was just me. I was one person, a one-person team. They called me the Fireball guy. So I would fly to Austin or Nashville or Seattle and literally just bar hop and buy people shots of Fireball. So for example, you know, 6th Street in Austin, Broadway and 2nd in Nashville, the Gas Lamp District in San Diego. I would hit the ground and just bar hop the hell out of the city, and every bar that had product, buy people shots of Fireball, let them try it. You know, we had a very non-traditional marketing strategy. We didn't do shot girls. We didn't do any kind of traditional sponsorships. I didn't hang banners or, you know, put up posters. It was buying shots for people, put it in their mouths and disappear into the night. Sometimes I said I worked for the company, and sometimes I just pretended to be this guy who was celebrating his birthday, or I got a raise, or just got engaged. And it was just like, what are we celebrating tonight? It's Tuesday. Let's party. Something that we realized, the longer I've been in the industry, we realized it's something that big brands can't do because they're too big and clunky. You know, like the big guys can't just send people out into the field to buy shots. They can send, you know, sales reps down at a very low level in order to try and do some of that. But like a Jim Beam or a Jack Daniels can't just give a kid a credit card and send them out into the world. Where some of the smaller brands can kind of do that. They can say, well, let's kind of turn the system on its head and go around the traditional methods of marketing for liquor.
Richard, there's a theme in your life that I'd like to know if you can explain. How come in Richard's life it seems like the heat is always on?
Yeah, I don't know. It's not a – it's there wasn't a lot of thought into that. I think it's kind of a coincidence. You know, I didn't seek out Fireball. They came to me. So I had no say in that. Being from New Orleans, obviously I love spice. So I dove in. The ghost opportunity kind of presented itself. That was an opportunity that also came to me. I didn't seek them out. My now business partner had the idea and contacted me because he saw my work with Fireball.
What is the concept behind Ghost Tequila?
So Ghost, the elevator pitch is Ghost Tequila is a 100% agave tequila infused with ghost pepper. So essentially, it is a Blanco tequila that we infuse with a ghost pepper extract during the distillation process. We make it in Mexico at a small family-owned distillery in the city of Tequila, which most people are surprised to know that there's a city called Tequila. But it's a very versatile product. You know, when we pitch it to bars and restaurants, it can go a lot of different ways. If you go to the college and the dive and the service industry bars, they're just doing straight shots of it, or maybe a Boilermaker, a shot in a beer kind of thing. If you go to restaurants or craft cocktail places, they're doing, you know, cool variations of spicy margaritas, Bloody Marias for brunch, Palomas, Negronis, Mexican mules, which is just a Moscow mule with tequila. So that's kind of the pitch. You know, a lot of brands pigeonhole themselves as a cocktail brand, as a mixer, or as a shooter brand. What we're trying to do is say, hey, you can do both with this brand, and it's working.
For people who may not be familiar with what a ghost pepper is, why ghost peppers and tequila?
Okay, so there is a system of measurement called the Scoville meter, and it measures how hot spicy food and beverages are against each other, right? So on the Scoville meter, ghost pepper is 1,000,000, which I think Tabasco is about 1,000. Ghost pepper is, from what I understand, one of the hottest naturally occurring substances in the world. So there are hotter peppers, but the ghost pepper is the hottest naturally growing one that man has found growing from the earth. Now, the thing that scares people is because a lot of people know that ghost peppers are very spicy, they look at it and they say, oh, that's going to ruin my life. That's going to kill me. But we use such a small amount that it's not as spicy as you think it's going to be. And that's the disclaimer I give to everyone, because we get a lot of people to try it at tastings or bars or restaurants. And the response we get from 99.9% of people who try it say, oh, that's not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Is that something you really want tied onto your product? Oh, it's not as bad.
Yes. Okay. It doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement, but those people who say that go back and get number two, number three, number four. We did a cool tasting video here in New Orleans, like for YouTube and Facebook, at Bayou Beer Garden in Mid-City. And we brought up all these people who were afraid to try it. We did some blind taste testing. Every single person said, that's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. They were scared at first, then said that, and then they wanted to do more shots. So I'm okay with people saying it's not as bad as they thought it was going to be because they're still drinking it. So I don't care, you know? If I can prove to them that they're going to enjoy it, then that's the win right there.
How far is your distribution gone now? What's happening with it?
So right now we are in Massachusetts, Louisiana, Texas, California, and we're just about to kick off in Rhode Island. Considering we only launched in the summer of 2016, and from then to where we are now, that's a very aggressive rollout strategy for a startup liquor brand. A lot of startup brands, when they first start, they spread themselves a little too thin and crash and burn. So I'm very happy with where we are now. And, you know, I mean, I couldn't be prouder to see accounts carrying Ghost and people remembering my face when I come in and going, hey, Ghost guy, cool. And that's the most exciting part to me, is feeling like we're doing something new and different and something that's really going to change the game.
Well, it's a pleasure to have this opportunity to talk to you, and
likewise.
I wish you all the success in the world.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a longtime listener.
Richard Pomez, a spicy man who loves some spicy liquor.
I am Janie Beauclair, the clairvoyant gourmet.
True believers talk about a sixth sense, but what about psychic power, so real you can taste it? When we phoned culinary clairvoyant Janie Beauclair, She immediately marveled us with a vision of our studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
So when you said where you were, as soon as you said where you were, I got a vision of a variety of old-time cast iron stoves, different cooking items, as in like old-time kitchen things. Is that the type of stuff that's in there?
Uncanny. After this spot-on reading, Janie basically had us hypnotized. I just had a few more questions. You have a very special designation as a 5C clairvoyant. What is that?
I do. Well, what that means is that I have five specific senses that are on very high alert, and I am able to channel and connect with spirit using a lot of my senses, being the clairvoyant vision, meaning that I get extra sensations within, but I also can hear very clearly who is talking to me from the other side. I get a clear taste in my mouth, as in I can taste different things that they want me to taste. I have clear sensations of my feelings. I can feel other people's body sensations within me if they're trying to explain something that they might have experienced. And I have the ability to smell things that they want me to smell from the other side. So all five of my senses are working overtime, if you will.
Janie, what's your earliest memory of having one of these experiences?
Kindergarten, actually. I definitely remember having conversations with three women that had crossed over, and my mom saying to me, "Who are you talking to?" And I told her that I was talking to my friends on the other side, and she thought they were my imaginary friends. And I remember having a clear conversation with them, and it was actually about cooking, because I had a little Susie Bake oven, and we were talking about something that I wanted to make. It was about recipes. And so that was my very first conversation that I actually remember, and it was based around the kitchen, which is interesting because now at this age in my life, most of my readings have food flavor within them and have a lot of kitchen connection to them. And as I got into my 20s and 30s, I realized how powerful it was as a healing tool. And so I got really excited about being able to help other people heal through connecting them to the other side.
Do the spirits actually give you recipes?
Yes, and that is so much fun. That started with my mom looking for recipes through my grandmother. My mom realized that none of her five siblings had gotten a specific recipe that they all loved as a kid. And I said, well, let's see if I can connect to her. Maybe she can give us the recipe. That worked out really well. And so I started to ask for recipes for a variety of different friends and people that were coming to me going, hey, can you get this from my great-grandmother and this and that? And now people will call me and say things like, I've been trying to make my aunt's potato salad, and I thought I knew how to do it, but something's not right. And then I'll connect with the auntie, and she'll say, oh, you're missing the garlic powder or something like that. And so I've been able to help people find their missing ingredients or actually walk them through how to make the things that they're trying to make. And basically, it's I hear the instructions and I see visually the little mini video of how to make it as we're going along. So it's real clear and it's real, real simple for the person that's on Earth to follow it.
Have you been collecting these recipes?
I have, actually, and I've created a cookbook, and it is recipes from the other side. It's recipes that I've channeled. I was so inspired to do that because I've tried so many of these recipes, and they're so much fun because they're old recipes. So it's not things that you hear about on these cooking shows today. It's not things that you see online. It's old, sacred, beautiful, ancestral, you know, mealtime recipes when meals were so much more meaningful. So what I've done is I've put the recipes down, but I also put a little information on who it came from and how they felt about cooking that recipe and when they used it, what it was for. Was it for a special occasion? Was it a once-a-week dinner? You know, what was it about? Because I felt like it would be fun for people to see not only this old-time recipe, but how it was felt by the person on the other side.
Janie, thank you so much for sharing your amazing story with us. And we hope to talk to you again soon on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. It's been such a pleasure hanging out with you guys today.
That was Janie Beauclair, the clairvoyant gourmet. Let me sleep all night in your soul kitchen. What is a Carolina Reaper pepper? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is a Carolina Reaper pepper? On August 7th, 2013, the Carolina Reaper pepper surpassed the Trinidad Scorpion by testing highest on the Scoville scale, the international measurement of heat. The Reaper was developed in Rock Hill, South Carolina, by a man who goes by the name Smokin' Ed Curry. Of course, there are regular pepper-eating contests, and just last year, Wayne Algenio of Jamaica, Queens, New York, won the World Ghost Pepper Eating Competition by consuming 22 of them in 60 seconds. Yikes. But watch out, Wayne. Earlier this year, Mike Smith of England's Nottingham Trent University introduced his Dragon's Breath pepper, which is purported to register a tiny bit higher on the scale. His results have been submitted to the Guinness Book of World Records, so you could say he's on the hot seat until the final results are in. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Seasons don't fear the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain. We can be like they are. Come on, baby, don't fear the reaper. Baby, take my hand. Don't fear the reaper. We'll be able to fly. Don't fear the reaper. Baby, I'm your man.
Hi, my name is Bill Schutt, and I'm a zoologist and biology professor at LIU Post in New York, and my book is Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History.
Cannibalism is no longer a thing of the past. Once associated with desperate pioneers trying to reach the West Coast, this foodie trend is taking off, at least according to New York-based writer Bill Schutt. Here at Louisiana Eats, we're always vying to be ahead of the curve, so I made a call to Bill to get the full story on a truly humanist cuisine.
I think that when you hear the word cannibalism, you have a knee-jerk reaction, and that is you're either thinking about people stranded in the Andes or the Donner Party, or you're thinking of criminal cannibalism like Jeffrey Dahmer. And as a zoologist, what I learned and what I want my readers to now know is that there's a lot of material that has to do with cannibalism that doesn't have to do with any of that, whether it's in the animal kingdom. Cannibalism functions for things as strange as parental care or a reproductive strategy. And then once you get into humans, the types of cannibalism that I looked at, besides the obvious ones, had to do with things like ritual cannibalism and medicinal cannibalism.
It's fascinating. Now, you devote some time talking about the people of the Caribbean, Mexico, and Central America. And there was a lot of cannibalism reality for various reasons, but there was also a lot of cannibalism lore, wasn't there?
Sure. I think this is one of the more interesting parts of the book, and people are in a sense surprised to hear this, is that folks like Columbus used the term cannibalism as a way to dehumanize the people that he met. On his first trip to the New World, for example, he described these Amerindians called Amerecs, and he said that they were very nice and they were fit to be working for the queen. And what he found out was that, well, he was actually there looking for gold. And when he didn't find gold, he started looking for another resource. And that resource turned out to be humans. And so Queen Isabella told him, listen, if these are nice people, if these people are kind, then you need to treat them with humanity. But if they happen to be cannibals, then all bets are off. So lo and behold, what a coincidence. Visits 2, 3, and 4, those voyages, were more like armed occupations than they were voyages of discovery. And all of these groups that were initially stated to be nice folks were suddenly these animal cannibals, and so they could be treated in really harsh ways. And so I'm not trying to say that cannibalism did not occur in these groups, because it might have, and it might have occurred for reasons that were probably ritual, might have had to do with their warfare, but it was also used as a way to sort of designate other groups as subhuman. So that, and if that was the case, you could really do anything you wanted to them. And this happened throughout the New World.
Some of them did actually use it, though, as a way to terrorize their enemies.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, in warfare. It was also used as in funerary rites. Instead, culture is king. It's all what your culture dictates is the right thing. They'd never learned about burying their dead, and a lot of these groups were just as mortified to learn that Westerners put their dead into the ground to rot and be eaten by worms. Yeah, and they were like, "What? Are you kidding me?" Well, probably not using those words, but why wouldn't you want to consume your dead loved ones and incorporate them into you? And so they were just as surprised at that type of behavior. And it's something that we'd never get in the West, because for thousands of years now, since the time of the ancient Greeks, we've been told and learned through the Greeks and the Romans, William Shakespeare, the Brothers Grimm, Daniel Defoe with Robinson Crusoe, that the worst thing that you could do to another person is to cannibalize him. And so these groups that did not get that line, they developed other rituals and other beliefs that were quite different in many instances. And probably a lot less cannibalism took place in these indigenous groups than has initially been reported by anthropologists. You know, we use a very different and more stringent set of evidence now before we go calling people cannibals. In the old days, if you found bones that had cut marks on them, it was automatically assumed that you were dealing with cannibals. That is not the case nowadays.
Well, they even had a studied opinion on who tasted best. So how did that go back then? Who got to eat and who got eaten?
Well, I think that in a lot of instances, very poor people got eaten, young people, women.
They really had a taste for children, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, and it sort of makes sense. You know, if you think about eating lamb versus eating an old steer,
sure,
it's really the same thing when you talk about what the meat would be like.
Well, that's going on way, way in the East, but in Europe, tell me about the times when and what their thoughts were behind medicinal cannibalism.
Sure. This was maybe the biggest surprise for me in the entire book. You know, with the animals, it was just how widespread cannibalism was in the animal kingdom. But for humans, the real surprise to me when I started to do the research on this book was how common medicinal cannibalism was for hundreds of years throughout Europe, starting in the Middle Ages, rolling right through the Renaissance, and lasting right up until the early 20th century. Just about every body part that you can imagine, from skulls and bones to fat and blood and guts, were prepared in any way that you can consider, from being dried out to being mixed with alcohol, all sorts of potions made, in order to treat all sorts of various diseases. And so this was a real surprise, given the Western taboo that these people had. But when it came to medicinal cannibalism, from kings to commoners, everybody was eating body parts for hundreds of years. And probably the last vestiges of that are now, you know, a relatively few folks who believe, in the United States primarily, that consuming placenta has a medicinal value. It's sort of an alternative medicine.
Do you think that cannibalism is likely to be viewed differently in the future? You know, there are all the zombies. There's all these things that we see now in movies and on TV. How do you see the current state and the future of cannibalism?
Well, what a great question. You know, cannibalism, like vampirism, is always, I think, going to stimulate people, cause them to have a shiver. And once again, I think this is 2,000 years worth of learning that cannibalism is the worst taboo that you can undertake. So it's going to take a long time, I think, for people to think differently. And I'm not trying with this book to tell people that cannibalism isn't horrible and that there hasn't been a lot of suffering and pain because of it. What I'm trying to get across is that there are other stories out there that don't necessarily fit in with what we've learned about cannibalism.
Well, we're facing climate change and great unrest on the planet. Do you think that those words, Soylent Green, are going to ever really make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for your listeners out there, that was a 1973 science fiction flick with Charlton Heston where the seas had died. And supposedly they were making these biscuits using people who turned themselves in once they reached old age. Yeah, and so, I mean, I really don't see anything like that happening. To me, the real problem is as it's been in the past, where you're dealing with famines in places where it's going to be difficult to bring in aid because of, say, armed factions that might be too dangerous to bring in. To bring in aid workers or medicinal people. And, you know, we're living in a world where we're reading about famines and starvation on a daily basis. And so it's not science fiction to me that in some of these instances that people might resort to cannibalism. I think it's predictable behavior. I'm not pro-cannibalism. I'm just saying that as a scientist, and scientists have looked at this, it is a natural step in the starvation process that at a certain point when there's no food, you're either going to die or you're going to eat the dead.
The history of the world, my love.
Save a lot of graves, do a lot of relatives' favors.
Is those below serving those up above?
Bill Shutt, author of Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History.
That those above will serve those down below.
Now let me sing.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans' French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.